So I want to go back into Rilke. Actually, I'm not sure I want to go back into Rilke, but I'm going to because I said I would. Excuse me, I'm having a symptom myself. And that's karma that's being acted out too. I don't want to give a literary criticism of all of these elegies, but I do want to go into them a little bit to understand the logical progression of what is being expressed and what is being hidden and what is being communicated between the lines or through, let's say, ambiguous and obscure allusions and metaphors. And so we'll start with the second elegy because we did the first one last time, in which he basically reveals the situation. But in the second elegy, he wants proof of it. And before we go into the second, I want to go back to the tenth, because remember, the first few lines of the tenth elegy were written very early on, in 1912, when he was still in Duino Castle. The others were written mostly in 1920, 22. So in the first few lines of the tenth elegy were written in the castle right after one of the seances that he participated in. And it says, "Someday emerging at last from this violent insight, let me sing out jubilation and praise to assenting angels." So this is when he has the insight and he has violent anger about it, that he is stuck in a body with his dead sister and her connection to the mother. And this is the reason for his gender confusion and his inability to get his life started, et cetera, et cetera. So just to that's the context in which the elegies are then written as he explores the nature of his own situation, and it's revealed to himself what is really going on that he wasn't clear about before this. So in the second elegy, he wants proof. How can I be sure that this is really the case and I'm just not crazy and a multiple disorder, personality disorder, right? How can you know if you hear the voice of someone else that it's not a superego and it's not some other kind of psychological pathology than this one? And so at the same time that he believes it, he's trying not to believe it. And he's totally ambivalent about what to do. He wants to call the angel. This time he does invoke the angel. But at the same time, he wants the angel to come down and not be scary and take the sister away. But he's also afraid he will get taken away. They'll both die if he calls the angel. So he's also not sure that he wants to call the angel. So he's going through his own fear that he will die, and his fear that if she leaves him, he won't be able to handle life without her, because he's so used to having her as part of his being that he's afraid that he won't be able to deal with life without that support, even though it's also a conflict. And so he says in the third verse or paragraph, "Though someone may tell us, yes, you've entered my bloodstream, the room, the whole springtime is filled with you, what does it matter? He can't contain us. We vanish inside him and around him. And those who are beautiful, oh, who can retain them?" You see, their voices are alternating. It's he that's speaking and then she's speaking. And it gets confusing if you don't recognize that the voice is shifting very subtly from line to line. And I think it's clear that the smile is hers. When he takes over, there's no smile. He's angry. But she is very happy because she's able to take over the body momentarily and express herself. So there are conflicting intentions that are happening here, and that he cannot control. And so Rene and Reiner are in a way enemies, but frenemies, and also lovers. And so lovers, if they knew how, might utter strange, marvelous words in the night air, but they don't really know how to speak to each other because they share the same body. It's very much like the All of Me. I think that was actually an accurate portrayal of the conflict and the love that are both existing between these two beings in one body, who can neither express their love accurately, but they cannot get away from each other. It's a hopeless situation, like most are in life. So we alone fly past all things, as fugitive as the wind, and all things conspire to keep silent about us, half out of shame, perhaps, half as unutterable hope. So you see, both of these feelings, this ambivalence, are both there, but it can't be spoken about. You know, if they were to speak about their situation, he would be locked up, right, as crazy. But lovers gratified in each other, I am asking you about us. So he wants to know from her. You hold each other, but where is your proof, you see? He and she both need the proof that there is real otherness there and not simply a fantasy or hallucination. See, sometimes I find that my hands have become aware of each other, or that my time-worn face shelters itself inside them. So I can be aware. My hands, yes, I can know there's two of them, and the two can hold the face, but I can't hold these two souls. I can't grasp fully what's going on. And he goes on with this. That gives me a slight sensation. But who would dare to exist just for that? You, though, who in each other's passion grow until overwhelmed, he begs you no more. You who beneath his hands swell with abundance like autumn grapes. You who may disappear because the other has wholly emerged. I am asking you about us. So he goes on like this, and usually this is interpreted as he's speaking about an external lover and a relationship with another person. But I think it's clear that he's speaking about this internal situation, that he cannot fully deal with, and neither one can properly understand the other or how the situation should be resolved. So he says, we can go this far, this is ours, to touch one another this lightly. The gods can press down harder upon us, but that is the gods' affair. So he doesn't want to even interfere with the karma, and he doesn't know how. He wants God to take this burden off of him, or them, but neither of them knows how to proceed. For our own heart always exceeds us, as theirs did, speaking about the Greeks, but he's really speaking, you know, about this situation, and we can no longer follow it, gazing into images that soothe it, or into godlike bodies where measured more greatly, it achieves a greater repose. They are between the living and the dead, between the ancient and the current, because she died some time back, and they cannot find peace between them. And so they're looking for models as to how to live together. Eventually, he will find the model he needs in another elegy. So then in the third elegy, he moves on to his guilt for his masculine sexuality, because, of course, she is the feminine, and he himself was raised as a girl, and so there's a real ambivalence about whether he should express his desire as a man, and the guilt for then in a way, eliminating the reality of the sister. So he goes through, you know, all of that guilt that I don't think falls into either an Oedipus complex or into any Jungian models of why he would have these ancient terrors that plunged him into the shock of this feeling that comes over him whenever he's in a sexual situation. And then in the middle of the second long paragraph, but did he ever begin himself really? And now he's angry at his mother. He says, "Mother, you made him small. It was you who started him. In your sight, he was new. Over his new eyes, you arched the friendly world and warded off the world that was alien." In other words, she overprotected him. She kept him feeling that she would always be there and he didn't have to have his own power to deal with his fear of the darkness, the fear of loneliness, or any of that. And she became the light. But she never passed the light on to him. The torch was never passed, and the father never passed it. So he was kept as a coward and effeminate and unable to develop his destiny. "So powerful was your presence as you tenderly stood by the bed. His fate, tall and cloaked, retreated behind the wardrobe, and his restless future, delayed for a while, adapted to the folds of the curtain." I think to the folds of her skirt. So he's complaining that he didn't get to develop his masculinity. So, and then he goes into the fantasies that he has when he's asleep, and the more feminine side of the fantasies that come up, as well as his murderous rage. And then at the bottom of the next page, he says, "Dear girl, this that we loved inside us, not one who would someday appear, but seething multitudes, not just a single child, but also the fathers lying in our depths like fallen mountains." So there's also the presence of the father in his subconscious. And it may well be that the father's spirit also came out of the father's guilt that he allowed this situation to happen. So what passions welled up inside him from departed beings? What women hated you there? How many dark, sinister men you aroused in his young veins? Dead children, I'm probably crying for them. Dead children reached out to touch you, you see. So he's again dealing with this terrible emotion that all of this is bringing, the whole dysfunctional family system, with the dead parents whose spirits have probably both joined them, and there's probably a real overcrowded situation in the body. And he talks about overcrowded gaze very often. Then moving into the fourth elegy, he's dealing directly with his inauthenticity. In the second line, we are not in harmony. Our blood does not forewarn us like migratory birds. She should have migrated. She should have gone to the light. She didn't go. And so late overtaken, we force ourselves abruptly into the wind and fall to earth at some iced over lake. So she tries to leave but falls. The situation can't be dealt with. Flowering and fading come to us both at once, alive and dead, and they can't deal with this. So he goes on to the situation that causes him to not be able to maintain any relationship with another person, especially with a woman. So he says, "Who has not sat afraid before his heart's curtain? It rose, the scenery of farewell, easy to recognize, the well-known garden which swayed a little. Then the dancer came, not him, enough. However lightly he moves, he's costumed, made up, an ordinary man who hurries home and walks in through the kitchen." So in other words, he has to leave relationships with others because he's too obsessed with his own and is too ambivalent and unable to know who he is with another. And so he has to run away. But at the same time, it creates terror of this loneliness that he covers over with an inauthentic dancer who's costumed and made up, who pretends he can handle everything easily, and he's an ordinary man, and everything is, you know, just the way it should be. But then he can't stand that. He says, I won't endure these half-filled human masks. Better the puppet. It at least is full. I'll put up with the stuffed skin, the wire, the face that is nothing but appearance. You see, he doesn't want to deal with the authentic feelings that these two beings are having within that are creating a chaotic incoherence. So, and yet he can't leave. He's the witness of all of this. He can't leave watching the stage where all of this is taking place. And he can't resolve it in any way, either through himself leaving the body or convincing her to leave or any of the other options. So he finally decides that it's resolved in this way. He's an angel and a puppet. The angel pulls his strings and he remains the puppet. So as long as he can still relate to something more real than himself, as long as he can try to bring the invisible understanding that comes through his poetry into the world, then he has some significance and he can make his life have meaning. So above, beyond us, the angel plays. If no one else, the dying must notice how unreal, how full of pretense is all that we accomplish here, where nothing is allowed to be itself. So, hours of childhood, when behind each shape more than the past appeared, because he's receiving the past in the present, and what streamed out from before us was not the future. We felt our bodies growing and were at times impatient to be grown up, half for the sake of those with nothing left but their grown-upness. So he's also seeing that his situation creates a richer inner life than other people have who are simply living on the surface in their egos, that he knows a secret about life that others don't know because of this very curse of being double within, and that it enables him to appreciate this pure event that has been created through this situation by his karma. But who knows a child as he really is, he says. Who sets him up? Who puts the measuring rod of distance in his hand? Who makes his death out of the gray bread which hardens and leaves it there inside his round mouth? Murderers are easy to understand, but this, that one can contain death, the whole of death, even before life has begun, can hold it to one's heart gently and not refuse to go on living, is inexpressible. So he's with a dead soul. He's with someone who shouldn't be there. And he is in the presence of death while alive. And it makes him realize that he is also, in a way, dead. And yet he must go on living. So he's living this paradox that is both inauthentic and yet somehow more authentic than all of the egos who are unaware of that this kind of thing can be going on below the surface. Now, the fifth elegy, I think, is the most important in terms of its giving a sense of his psychic structure that he recognizes when he encounters the Saltimbanque painting by Picasso. So this is the key. Has everyone seen this close up? So there's a young man holding the hand of a girl. So that's him and his sister. And there he has the father in front of him, the mother is here off to the side, and then these two younger versions of himself. So this painting is giving him all of the factors that are going into his psychic structure now, and how they are affecting him. So who are they? This translation says wanderers, but others say acrobats. Even more transient than we ourselves, because they're a painting and they will disappear. So for whose sake has all of this happened, he's wondering. And who has made this happen? So he can't reach to an appreciation yet of karma or God, but he is appreciating that he is stuck in no man's land. I think the suburban sky is the sky that's neither in the country nor in the city. It's kind of nowhere, and he's in his situation like a bandage. And the earth is wounded, his life is wounded, and yet it's the only way he can go on being. And so he talks about all of these figures, of course the weightlifter shrunk in his enormous skin, which looks as if it had once contained two men, right? And the other were already lying in the graveyard. So again, you have this double soul kind of tableau that he's expressing. And he's talking about all of the different aspects of himself, and that he cannot smile anymore because of his anger and his hatred for his mother and for the situation and his grief over this curse. So he displays equanimity. He talks about the display fruit, but he can't feel it in his heart. And so he's trying to resolve it. He's trying to have the two of them get along in the body, but he can't make it stable. Oh, where is the place? I carry it in my heart where they still were far from mastery, still fell apart from each other, like mating cattle that someone had badly paired. And so this sense of inability to remain in harmony, I think, is basically what most of this is about. And he wants to attain a kind of mastery in which he can dominate the sister, but in a way that she will accept. So that's basically what he attempts to do in the sixth elegy, where the male aspect, Reiner, takes over, but gives Renee a place and a purpose as the source of his inspiration, his muse. And so here he talks about the fig tree. It omits the blossoms, but goes right to the fruit. So he's going to produce poetry, even though he can't blossom as a man. He can't blossom in life, but he can produce the fruit of poetry. And now he feels like the god stepping into the swan. You remember Leda and the swan? Zeus, who is always, of course, falling in love with women, he actually becomes a swan, but it's like two in one. And takes over and makes love to her. So he's pointing out that the dominant god can enter and take over the body and run the life, manage the situation, and not be in there in a conflict. So he's trying to describe, and I think probably to convince himself, that he will be able to do this. And so he talks about power images, like the galloping horses before the triumphant pharaoh in the mildly hallowed reliefs at Karnak. Now he's calling himself a hero. The hero was strangely close to those who died young. Yes, he's very close. Permanence does not concern him. He lives in continual ascent, moving on into the ever-changed constellation of perpetual danger, the danger of, again, of falling into this duality that is chaos. But fate, which is silent about us, suddenly grows inspired and sings him into the storm of his onrushing world. I hear no one like him. All at once I am pierced by his darkened voice carried on the streaming air. So the male side is taking control. Oh, how gladly I would hide from the longing to be once again, oh, a boy once again, with my life before me, to sit leaning on future arms and reading of Samson. So now he wants to be Samson. He doesn't want to be the boy anymore. But he's remembering to his mother, choosing to be a boy. Wasn't he a hero inside you, mother? Didn't his imperious choosing to be male, already begin there in you? Thousands seethed in your womb wanting to be him. But look, he grasped and excluded, chose and prevailed. So I think that the sister, because she was a spirit, you know, when someone is possessed by a spirit, they have access to other spirits. They live in a vibrational frequency in which other spirits are real to them, and they actually have relationships with them. And I think she actually invited others in, even probably while his body was in the womb. But he prevailed, and now he will prevail again consciously. And then he says, about the girl, virgins have plunged lamenting from the highest rim of the heart, sacrifices to the sun. So she must sacrifice so that he can live and be successful. But to do it in a way, he says, the hero stormed through the stations of love. Each heartbeat intended for him lifted him up beyond it, and turning away, he stood there at the end of all smiles. So he wasn't smiling anymore. He's serious, but transfigured. So then he goes into the seventh elegy, and he's basically saying, stop wasting time now. Let's get down to business. Stop wooing. In other words, stop womanizing, which he was doing in his external life. But also stop wooing the sister, and get down to work. But both of them have to do this, so that still unseen she would sense you, the silent lover, in whom a reply slowly awakens, and as she hears you grows warm, the ardent companion of your most daring emotion. So he wants her to be a companion, but a companion who is a muse, not someone who is going to create ambivalence and chaos. So from the first small questioning notes intensified all around by the sheltering silence of a pure affirmative day. So he is looking forward to a simple affirmation of his being as a single soul, and so. But look, I was calling for my lover, but not just she would come. Out of their fragile graves, girls would arise and gather. For how could I limit the call once I called it? These unripe spirits keep seeking the earth. Children, one earthly thing truly experienced, even once, is enough for a lifetime. Don't think that fate is more than the density of childhood. And here I think he's talking about the density of so many spirits that are coming together, but he's dominating them. He's keeping them as children while he is in the hero position. Truly being here is glorious. And so even you knew it, you girls who seem to be lost, to go under. He has found himself. He's in his power, and now he's transformed. So he's moving, but at the same time, where once an enduring house was, now a cerebral structure crosses our path, completely belonging to the realm of concepts, as though it still stood in the brain. So in other words, he can live and he can dominate, but he can only do it in the field of poetry because that's where they share the same goal. That's where they have this in common. Both of them were trained to love poetry by the mother. And so as long as he gives her that role, she will accept his being the dominant figure. And then he says about this happening, each torpid turn of the world has such disinherited ones, to whom neither the past belongs nor what yet has nearly arrived. So in a way, he's singing about her. He's writing his poems about her tragedy of dying young and being disinherited, not having a body of her own. And so he's feeling compassion. And that is allowing her to accept the situation. For even the nearest moment is far from us. Here, the translation is mankind, but other translations just say from us. And I think he means just the two of them. But strengthened in our task of preserving the still recognizable form. So they're recognizing this this situation that seems formless from the outside, but indeed is very much involved with two different forms at the subtle level. Okay, so I'm going to skip a lot of this. And at the end, after he continues to woo her, he says, "Don't think I'm wooing. Don't think I'm wooing." He's calling her now angel. "And even if I were, you would not come, for my call is always filled with departure. I want you to go still. Against such a powerful current, you cannot move. Like an outstretched arm is my call, and its hand, held open and reaching up to seize, remains in front of you, open as if in defense and warning. Ungraspable one, far above." So he's warning her, don't come too close. But he's also trying to take care of her needs. In the eighth, there's still a deadlock or a death lock in which they can't resolve. He says in the two-thirds of the way down, "But neither can move past the other. And it changes back to world, from inside to outside, forever turned toward objects," but he means mental objects. "We see in them the mere reflection of the realm of freedom, which we have dimmed." So they're still in conflict within. It hasn't been resolved yet, even in the eighth elegy. "For it too feels the presence of what often overwhelms us, a memory, as if the element we keep pressing toward was once more intimate, more true, and our communion into infinitely tender. But here all is distance. There it was breath. After that first home, when they were still unaware that they were two, the second seems ambiguous and drafty. Oh, the bliss of the tiny creature who remains forever inside the womb that was its shelter." So he's reminding her that she is still so tiny. She has never grown up. She is still in there as a very as a bud rather than a fully flowered ego or psychological construction. "And how bewildered is any womb-born creature that has to fly." So he can handle it, but he's saying she cannot. She's terrified. "And fleeing from itself, it zigzags through the air the way a crack runs through a teacup, so that the bat quivers across the porcelain of evening." So this is erring way in which they have to relate to each other and to the body. It fills us. We arrange it. He arranges the way they relate, but it breaks down. We rearrange it and then break down ourselves. "Who has twisted us around like this so that no matter what we do, we are in the posture of someone going away? Just as upon the farthest hill, which shows him his whole valley one last time, he turns, stops, lingers. See, he can't leave. He wants to himself die and resolve it that way. But he says, no, I linger. So we live here, forever taking leave, never taking leave, stuck neither alive nor dead in a limbo. But then in the ninth elegy, it's resolved. It's the Daphne resolution. Okay, and this is the key to how he is able to manage his life and then sing the sonnets to Orpheus, which are completely different, no longer lamenting the curse, but now able to praise the situation. And does everyone know the myth of Apollo and Daphne? It's an incredibly beautiful Greek myth, and there's an amazingly beautiful statue that I know I've seen, and I don't remember what museum it was in. It must have been in Europe, probably, at least, or New York, maybe. But anyway, it's a beautiful statue of two beings. Apollo falls in love with Daphne, who's a nymph, and he chases her. And as he's about to catch her, she doesn't want to be caught by him and seduced. She cries out to her father, who's a very high-level river god, and says, "Turn me into a laurel tree." And the statue, the sculpture that I've seen, is very beautiful. Apollo is starting to grab her by the waist, but her torso is already turning into a trunk of a tree, and her hands are up and they're turning into branches and her fingers into leaves. So she's becoming a tree in that very moment. And so he cannot capture her as a love object. So what Apollo decides is, I will love this laurel tree, and I will turn the laurel into the sign of victory, and I will make the greatest poets into the poet's laureate, right? And so he decides now that the two of them can have this relationship. He will be the poet laureate, she will be the laurel. She will produce the poems that he writes. And thus the two of them will again be one, and he can wear the crown of this laurel, but she will become a dead tree, as it were. She won't interfere in the conduct of life, but only in the production of poetry. And this relates to the sonnets to Orpheus. Let's see, let me go to the very first one. A tree ascended there, O pure transcendence, O Orpheus sings, O tall tree in the ear. So you see, she has decided to accept the offer, and she will be in his ear telling him the poems, but she won't interfere in his life. And so in the sonnets to Orpheus, he is talking about her living on as the muse. In the second one, in the final verse, where is her death now? Will you discover this theme before your song consumes itself? Where is she vanishing? A girl almost. So it's in this resolution that he's now able to go on. So the ninth elegy is the celebration, but it's still a work in progress. It hasn't been fully achieved. It's been conceptualized, and now they have to work it out. And so in the fourth verse here, he says, "And so we keep pressing on, trying to achieve it, trying to hold it firmly in our simple hands, in our overcrowded gaze, in our speechless heart, trying to become it." So this is what he is trying to arrange in the ninth elegy. So I'm not going to go into all of the allusions in them, but I think that's the main thing to get from this, that he has finally found a way to live. And then in the 10th elegy, it's basically an acceptance of his fate, that Sometimes it'll work, sometimes it won't. It's not perfect, but he accepts life with all of its problems, all of its vulgarity, all of the errors, and he accepts the curse as a blessing. Let my joyfully streaming face make me more radiant. Let my hidden weeping arise and blossom. How dear you will be to me then, you nights of anguish. Why didn't I kneel more deeply to accept you, inconsolable sisters? And surrendering, lose myself in your loosened hair. How we squander our hours of pain. How we gaze beyond them into bitter duration to see if they have an end. So he's saying he's not going to, you know, hope for one day her to leave and the situation will be better. Now he has to celebrate it as it is. So I think I'm not going to go into all of the details of this, but basically he's describing, you know, his life, the bitterness, the vulgarity, the gender dysphoria, the lamentation, the pearls of grief, and all of the confusion of their duality. And he describes a time when he went to Egypt and he spent a night out in the desert in front of the Sphinx. And there he had a recognition that the Sphinx is also double, right? It's an animal body, but a human head. There's that same duality. And when he goes into one of the temples, he sees pictures of the double crown of the pharaoh. It's called the Pshent, which is in the original German, that Egyptian word. It's the double crown. It's the time when the northern Egypt and southern were united in one kingdom. So he's saying, okay, the two can share a double crown. We don't have to fight anymore. We'll both live together as a double unity. And then he mentions fictional constellations in the sky, starting with the rider. I think the rider is interesting. Because in Sonnet to Orpheus number 11, it starts out, "Look at the sky. Are no two stars called rider? Which one is the rider and which one is the horse being ridden?" Right there, in a way, fighting over it, but accepting. "For this is printed strangely on us here, this pride of earth. And look, the second figure who drives and halts it, to whom it has to bear." So they can't quite get their drive in gear, right? And so just a touch possesses new expanses, and the two are one. Or are they really? Don't both signify the path they ride together now, but table and pasture keep them separate utterly. Even the starry union is a fraud. Yet gladly, let us trust the valid symbol for a moment. It's all we need. So, you know, he's hoping for the best, and then in the end, he tries to climb, you know, the mountains of grief and die away from this situation, but he falls back. He can't leave her, and here's where I think the most important and obvious image comes at the end of the 10th. "But if the endlessly dead awakened a symbol in us, perhaps they would point to the catkins hanging from the bare branches of hazel trees." Did anyone look up what catkins look like? Very interesting. It's two. They're a double. Two long phallic botanical objects hanging from these trees. But they're double. They're twins. And so he is saying, you know, this is what we have to accept. And he has to fall back into this like the raindrops that fall on the dark earth. And we who have always thought of happiness as rising, as leaving, as dying out of this horrible situation, would feel the emotion that almost overwhelms us whenever a happy thing falls. It's actually not a happy thing in the original. It's more that a thing, a spirit falls and falls into happiness, but a happiness that is simply the acceptance of madness and of impossibility. So anyway, that's the to me the story of All of Me, of Rilke's version, and his attempt to express it and create a meaningful life in poetry. But I don't think he hinted at this constantly. The allusions to the duality is there in every poem, but at the same time, it's never fully confronted. And so I think that it was still too out there to be able to fully face. Because if he had, I think that he could have hired an exorcist to have gotten rid of her very easily and solved the situation probably in one afternoon. But somehow he never decided to do that, you know. People can be depossessed of these situations. It's not that hard, but you have to be able to face it and then find a professional who knows how to do the work, which I imagine he was never able to get hold of. Okay, that's all I have to say for this evening. The floor is open if any of you feel interested enough to make a comment. Or anyone on Zoom?
Thank you. This is like a,
I don't know, like a incredible story that is very difficult to. I don't know how you figured it out.
But, I think it was pretty easy, actually.
But I do remember, I don't know where exactly I read in one of the books that he actually was invited to this castle, right, where this woman used to have these sessions, I don't know, I imagined,
yeah.
like, of yeah. spirits.
Seances, yeah.
Seances.
Spiritism is what they call
spiritism.
That act.
Where they yeah. call on...
They call spirits.
Spirits. Yeah. Is that how he found out
yeah,
about her?
Yeah, I'm almost sure. I don't have definite proof, but all of the evidence, especially from his letters and mm-hmm. other documents that I've read, indicate that in one of the seances, she left his body and spoke through the medium to him, and suddenly he got it.
Wow. Yeah. Okay, I just wanted to... Because it occurred to me that that might have been how he found out.
Oh, yeah. I think it is.
And... just trying to understand spiritually when something like this is revealed to one, let's say, and you're saying that these cases occur more and more often these days because of the lack of bodies to reincarnate, what is the meaning of to someone's life to have such a situation? Like, what is there to be
it depends.
To be learned?
There are so many different variations. Like, for example... I had in my days as a past life regressionist, et cetera, a number of cases, several of people who got possessed after surgery because when you're in anesthesia, you're kicked out of the body. But as it's wearing off, there's a lot of dead bodies in hospitals. I mean, dead spirits of dead, you know, people who have just left their body. And they hang around the surgery room. And then they try to get in at the end of surgery. And they can just get in as the anesthesia is getting weaker and take over. And often they can kick out the original person, or suddenly there's two of them there, and a person can feel different, not know what's going on, but suddenly there's a different personality, and they're having this kind of a struggle. I've also had I had one very interesting case of a woman who had a heart transplant, and the woman whose heart it was came with her body, and wouldn't leave, but the woman who took the heart felt so guilty she didn't want her to leave, and somehow they wanted to work out a harmonious way of being together. But it didn't work, and eventually, you know, we had to ask her to leave. But it was that one created a lot of pain for both of them, because the heart had so much symbolic meaning to her. So there are more and more of these kinds of cases that occur as a result of surgery and as a result of people in altered states. They can be possessed while they're on ayahuasca or on other drugs, in which they're open to spirits, and those possessions can stay with them, and it can cause psychotic kinds of breaks and other things if one doesn't know what's going on, if the shaman is not really aware of the fact that these kinds of things can happen. Even alcohol overdoses, right? A lot of delirium tremens. Why they call it spirits is because spirits can come in. So it's not uncommon that possession happens, but this kind that happens in the womb and happens with a maternal command in a way to stay together, that's more unusual. But it's not uncommon, and there are many different kinds of relationships, especially if the spirit had a past life relation with the host soul. Then they may feel like they owe it to them to give them a home and that kind of thing, and maybe the host murdered the other one, and now the other one wants to take the body of that one and feels justified. So often I had to do real mediations between two souls and let one speak and then the other in order for them to work out how they were going to resolve this, and then finally, who had the right to the body, who could make the other leave, and had the authority to do that. So it's a very complicated karmic kind of situation. But I think every therapist needs to understand this as one of the possible ways of interpreting symptoms. No? Okay. Anyone? Good.
Thank you for this satsang. It was a fascinating story. I find the whole topic very fascinating and mind-boggling.
It's very new. When reading the elegies the first time and before these satsangs, I kind of had the idea that he was in many cases talking about soul consciousness, being dead while alive and losing one's name and not seeing the world in the same way and all of these things. So my questions kind of pertain to that. I think the first one is, in the case of Renee, what's to say of her state of being? Let's say, because it doesn't seem like she had the full opportunity to develop an ego, like you mentioned as well, that blossoming. Did she develop an ego through Reiner in some way, or was she more in a state of soul consciousness than Reiner's ego, for example? I don't know if you could say something about
that. Yeah, I don't think soul consciousness, even though they are souls, but they're souls still with an ego, and that's why they can't leave. They're still attached to the body, even though she, of course, is in a male body. But she's actually, because she died at a week old, so she's stuck. She's frozen in time. She's very immature and very needy, and very weak. And so that's why she's terrified of death, even though she's already dead. So, and that's why you can't say she's soul conscious, because true soul consciousness, you know, the body can die and that's fine. There's no, you're not attached to it. But she's very attached, and attached to the figure of the mother, whether the mother's spirit is there or not. But she's very much attached, and the body, in a way, is identified as the mother, because you know I and the mother are one. When the fetus is inside the mother's body, those two bodies are the same, and so your body is the mother's body. So she doesn't want to leave the body, which even though it's male, it represents the mother also. And he, of course, was brought up as a girl, so there is still a partial identification with his child self. And so she was able to grow some kind of a childhood identity in addition to that identity as the infant. And so I think she had both of these possibilities. And she grew a little bit through his growth, but there was always a sense of it not being right. And she would have wanted to lead a very different life as a female. So she never fully developed and never fully was able to release the needy ego so that she could die. And the same thing with him, really, even though he grew much more psychologically. But I think he never outgrew his mother complex, which is why he stayed so attached to Lou Andrea Salome his whole life, and then to Rodin as his father figure. And so I think he remained psychologically a child.
That explains a lot also of the, well, just the conflict that they had. Being with, in a sense, a one-week-old psychology that has had some development.
Yeah.
Thank you. That clears it up. And there was one question about the, I think it was in the ninth elegy, where, and it was mentioned in the book as well, Spirit in Ashes, where he says, perhaps we are here in order to say house, bridge, fountain, gate, pitcher, fruit tree, window, at most column, tower. But to say them, you must understand. Oh, to say them more intensely than the things themselves. When reading Spirit in Ashes, I got the idea that she's sort of talking about the meaninglessness of how many of the things that we say usually, and we don't say them with the symbolic meaning or the signifier behind it even. What is he talking about here? Yeah. I couldn't really understand it. Yeah. But
well, it's a good point. I don't think she got Rilke at all. Right, from at least certainly not in the way we do. But to me, those objects were transitional objects in the Freudian sense. They were objects that were related to the mother, that gave them a sense of security, that gave them a sense of belonging, and this is home, and we're safe, and all of that. And so I think they were tied to these and had a need of them. Even though he would talk about the world having need of him, but he had a need of the world and of having these objects that would be familiar. So I think, and because he couldn't understand himself psychologically because of this duality, all that he could really talk about were things, not actually souls. So you didn't see really an understanding of the soul except almost subconsciously as it's being expressed in the painting of Picasso and other things that he alludes to, but it's not even clear how deeply he understands why he was mesmerized by that painting. He couldn't leave it for months. He had to stare at it. But, he was staring at his own psychological, mental objects, but did he really fully understand that? And I think he had to write in order to try to figure it out, but I don't think he fully did.
And then the objects were, in a sense, they grounded him because his... Yeah.
Yeah. Grounded Thank both you. Of them.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Thank you, Shunya.
Marjorie mm-hmm. Lamont.
So, as one is likely to come across these cases evermore,
mm-hmm.
and something that I've become aware is the ego fragments that may remain.
Yes.
Right. That will get triggered in these situations, although one may have not had,
right.
a double soul syndrome.
Yeah.
So the role that one may play as a therapist in these cases, you were saying one needs to know how to deal with it.
Yeah.
And what I'm realizing is the depths of that comes out in oneself, mm-hmm. and such as. In this particular case, how the feminine had to be so repressed in my ego development. Mm-hmm. So there's this inner struggle. Mm-hmm. That, you know, I've always felt it, yeah, in a somatic way, yeah, in there in this lower plexus is being torn apart,
yeah,
between the command to be a boy and, yeah, and being in the female body.
Yeah.
And so it's I'm experimenting with this situation in a very raw way.
Mm-hmm.
So the exorcism that you speak of really has to be one's own exorcism,
yes,
first.
Yes.
Get it all out.
Yeah.
And then one can serve, yeah, from that learning, that experience, yeah, from oneself, that raw struggle,
yeah,
that you say he could never really face,
yeah,
he could never really speak about.
Right.
And so... if you could say more in terms of this training, mm-hmm, that this process.
Yes. Okay, what you say is very important. You know, the universe being fractal, the ego at its fractal level is going through the same thing as souls go through. So even if you don't have a double soul, you have a double ego because it was split into the male and female, and one had to dominate and the other had to be repressed. And that relationship now has to be equalized, but it can't be done through a choosing one or the other, because in fact everyone is both, male and female and beyond, and ultimately the soul is genderless because it's just pure light, awareness, intelligence, but without any duality. So I think the only way the healing can actually happen is to transcend the ego level and get to the next higher level, which is the soul, and then both of those fragments can be united as aspects of yin and yang of the consciousness having an ability to have all of what would be called masculine virtues, because in a way it's arbitrary. What was a boy in the culture you grew up in might have been very different than what a boy would have been, let's say, 1,000 years ago in Greece or something. So these elements have to be harmonized and recognized as being universal virtues of any human being, whether in a male or female body, but that are actually virtues of the soul. And once you have recognized that and accepted that, then the torment, which is at the level of desire, not of love, can be sublimated, and one is able to love again, rather than the question of, am I allowed to have female desire or only male desire or anger or, you know, aggression, or am I allowed to have the wholeness of the ability to relate in freedom without having to make these choices? But that can only be done once the ego is transcended, right?
Yeah. Okay, thank you.
All right. Thank you. Anyone else? Mm-hmm.
Thank you. I wanted to ask, maybe back to the topic of possession, what's the difference between the possession by an entity and possession by a soul, or is it the same thing?
Yes, yeah, they're the same.
And also, the strengthening the auric field, is that about a high enough vibrational frequency where those entities can't enter because it's too high for them to kind of penetrate, or how does that...
You see, the soul is emanating light. So the soul is producing an aura, a corona, literally, like the sun has a corona. This crown of light surrounds the body, and it keeps out any negative vibrations, and it keeps out any spirits who shouldn't trespass in your space. But it's a space of love and of luminosity and of positive energy. When the ego, however, because of its moods, can often be depressed, and suddenly it's contracting. It's not putting out energy. Its energy is actually concave. And that's when energy, when beings can come in. If you're depressed or anxious or in a confused and split state or spaced out or something, you have holes in your aura. And in some way, you may even be inviting a spirit to come in. You're lonely, or you feel too weak to deal with the situation, and some entity says, "Well, I'll help you deal with it," you know. And you, oh, okay, you know, and you don't even know what's going on, but subconsciously a deal is made, and then click, suddenly you're not alone in there. So you have to stay in soul consciousness. If you're in the ego, you're vulnerable. Because the ego is going to be sometimes convex and sometimes concave. And these days, much more often, it's in a state of worry and anxiety and fear, which makes its auric field disappear or become very weak. And so you want to be in a state of empowerment all the time.
But a dark entity wouldn't have, obviously, a luminous aura, that soul.
Dark entity, no.
No. Because you said the soul is in a state of light and
oh, yeah, but we're talking about an earthbound entity in which the mm-hmm. soul is asleep. The soul is in there, but it's a ghost that did not kill its ego. You know, you have to go through three deaths. The body has to die, the ego has to die, and then the soul has to die into God. It went through one death, but not the other two. And so the soul is present, but it's the ego that's running the show.
So the dead soul has an ego.
If it's an earthbound entity, uh-huh. it means its ego didn't die. And it has a subtle body. And it has an electromagnetic aura. You can feel it. It's not luminous usually, but you can detect it when it comes into the room. Cats are very good at detecting it, and they'll suddenly go like this. They know when a spirit's there, but even dogs will also. So that's one reason why people have kept these animals around, particularly shamans and witches and people who are aware of these kinds of things, because the cat would give them warning. But you can detect it without needing an animal to do it if you are aware of that level of reality.
Okay.
Right.
I'll get a cat.
You're going to get a cat now. Everybody will soon have cats. So. What are you going to do when the cat goes like this, though?
You'll strengthen my auric field.
Yeah, okay. Keep it strong anyway, and you don't need the cat, so. But the cats do have that value, among other things, and they are very very much aware of earthbound spirits. So it is something to pay attention to if the cat is suddenly acting very strangely. Anyone else? Going once, twice, sold. Okay, has this been useful to people? Okay, we're done with Rilke now, okay? We'll go back to this other book that also gets everything wrong, but in different ways. But that'll be after the retreat. She gets this thing about Zeno totally wrong, but we'll go into that another time. But let's read the next chapter for whenever we do another one of these book groups. But for now, let's all focus on becoming avadutas. If you're not one already, because that's the revolution that we now have to accomplish. So, thank you all. Namaste.
Namaste.